Dobrodošli u još jednu epizodu Bezbedne priče. Današnja gošća je Jinglan Li, koja je došla u Srbiju povodom godišnje konferencije Bezbednost i odgovornost koju Centar za nestalo zlostavljanu decu održava 9. godinu za redom. Jinglan Li je poznata po tome što je održala više od 70 forenzičkih intervjua sa decom koja su seksualno zlostavljena. Nadam se da će ova epizoda pomoći svim stručnjacima da usvoje neko novo znanje i da će im pomoći da inkorporiraju to što su čuli u svoj rad.
First of all, Jing, thank you so much for agreeing to be my guest. It is an honor.
Thank you for having me and giving me this opportunity.
We'll be speaking about children that have survived the sexual abuse. So after the child discloses that that terrible thing happened to them, some children display some unusual behavior. So why is that? Why do we notice such thing?
So there's different phases in which we could talk about that, and they're a little bit different. So in terms of, the abuse happening, sometimes we notice changes in their behavior even before they disclose. So sometimes they might become withdrawn, or they might, start wetting the bed or engaging in abnormal behavior. And when I say abnormal, I mean abnormal to them. But at the same time, some of these children will, after abuse, not display any changes, and they'll do great in school, and they'll continue to be social and happy on the outside and things like that. So there's that stage of it. But post-disclosure, which is, I think, the more specific question you're asking, after a child discloses, whether it's to a social worker, a teacher, a friend, law enforcement, a lot of times when they're talking about the abuse, they can behave in ways that we don't really think is normal. And what do we mean by that? Sometimes when they tell what happened to them, they might be inconsistent. They might say it happened at the blue house in the room upstairs. But the next time you ask them, it might be in the greenhouse, on the third floor. And there's often a reason for that inconsistency. For example, it could have happened in both those places, but today that child only remembers a particular set of events, especially if the abuse has gone on over years. At the same time, a child might laugh when they're talking about these horrible things. And a lot of people in the public think, it's so terrible what happened to you. Why aren't you crying or upset? And there's a multitude of reasons why they might be laughing. For example, they're uncomfortable talking about their private parts and things like that. Or they laugh because it's a defense mechanism, because if they don't laugh, they might cry, right? So there's so many reasons that they might do these sorts of behaviors. And so if a child is disclosing to the public, a parent, a friend, law enforcement, and we expect them to act a certain way, then we're not giving them a fair chance to actually tell the truth of what happened to them.
What are some strategies we should use when talking to a child that has survived sexual abuse? I imagine that we can make some mistakes when child discloses that this terrible thing happened to them.
Yeah, I think that there's a difference between being the person they're reporting it to and then doing what we call a forensic interview from the law enforcement perspective. But starting with the disclosure to one of us as a friend or someone they're confiding in, I think one of the strategies is to listen with an open mind. And an example I like to give is I had a case where a little boy would say, I saw my sister get touched by the perpetrator through the door. But this door is a bedroom door. There's no peephole. There's no keyhole. And so the detective did not really believe this child in the beginning. And then so the detective thought the case was weak because no one else saw what happened to this little girl. But we charged the case anyway, and we put this child, the witness, onto the stand. And he testified, yes, I saw it happen through the door. And as I asked him questions, I realized someone had damaged the door. There was a hole in the door. And nobody had ever told us that. The victim, survivor, didn't tell us that. This boy didn't tell us that. Because as children, they assume you know what their house looks like. And so in asking those questions, we realized, and then we called the mom in, and the mom said, oh yeah, some movers had damaged the door when moving furniture, so there's actually a hole in that door. So sometimes we don't believe what children say because we write them off as children and we discount them, but they know a lot more than we give them credit for. And the most important thing is just to give them that chance to tell the truth. And the same thing happens during the disclosure itself. The strategy is about building trust and making sure the child does not feel like you're judging them or that they're in trouble or that you don't believe them. That trust is essential for them to tell you the full story of what happened.
Yeah, I can imagine when child, for example, discloses to their parent, the initial reaction might be disbelief or maybe surprise and even in some cases anger.
Yes.
So I imagine that we can make that mistake. Like, why did you put yourself in that situation? But we're putting blame on the children who are helpless.
Yes, and I think that's especially common the older the child is. So when the child is, you know, under the age of 7 or 9, you know, something younger, a lot of times we think they're mistaken or they're confused or they're just making things up or they had a bad dream. And then when they get older into their early teens and late teens, we start thinking they're lying, they're trouble kids, or they want attention.
Mm-hmm.
But in any of those circumstances, if you're under the age of 18, you are a child and the perpetrator is an adult. So it is the adult's responsibility, not the child's. The child did not choose to be molested. And even in cases where maybe a very young girl likes, you know, gets groomed or, you know, gets into a relationship with an older perperpetrator, that's still the perpetrator's
exactly.
responsibility, you know, to not engage in that relationship. And something very interesting you said that I think is very insightful from you. Yes, very commonly in the cases I have, the oftentimes the mother or the caretaker will blame the child. Why didn't you tell me? Why didn't you run away?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't you fight back? And, you know, sometimes the child realizes their fears are true because they'll say, this is why I didn't tell you, because you don't even believe me.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah.
At a conference, which happened yesterday, many of the people who will be listening to this podcast didn't attend. They wanted to, but we didn't have any place. You talked about, the Lion 10-step process.
Yes.
And it was really interesting to me, really something that stuck with me because I heard that a lot of people make mistake exactly, not following the process.
Yes.
So can you briefly describe it for our listeners?
Yes. So Thomas Lyon is a law professor and a professor of psychology at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And through, you know, various research and studies and information compiled about how children understand questions, how children behave when questioned, he developed this 10-step process. Mm-hmm. And we tend to apply it to the letter if it's a particularly young child. You know, if the child's 17 or 16 and older, sometimes there are things you can deviate from, especially in the rapport building process, because they're cognitively more capable of distinguishing, you know, from the types of questions we're asking. Mm-hmm. But when they're very young, we really follow this. And the reason I'm pulling it up on my phone is even in talking to you, I don't want to misspeak. And even having done, you know, 70 such interviews, I still always pull out that paper and follow along to make sure that I'm doing it right.
That's okay.
And the first four categories are the I don't know instruction, the don't understand instruction, the you're wrong instruction, and the ignorant interviewer. And I'm going to briefly talk about what each of these are.
Mm-hmm.
So in the I don't know instruction, you're advising the child, if I ask you a question and you don't know the answer, then you can say, I don't know. For example, if I asked you, what is my dog's name? What would your answer be?
Well, I don't know.
Right? Because you don't even know if I have a dog.
Exactly.
And yes. Then if a child guesses, sometimes I've had a four-year-old say, I think it would be Fido or something. And then, you know, you have to talk to them about why that's a guess. And then they'll understand and then you can go back to the questions. But, you know, you don't even know if I have a dog. But if I ask you, do you have a dog? You would say,
Yes, I don't know. I don't. Sorry.
See, people get get confused. They get nervous, right?
Caught off guard.
Yes, right. And so children do that, and there might be a moment like that where everybody laughs, and then it gives them the opportunity to sort of loosen up and relax, and then you can go back to the questions. You said that you don't have a dog, so you wouldn't have a dog's name because you don't even have a dog. And so once that child understands that, then you move on to the next step, which is, I don't understand. And this is also designed, again, for clarity and trust with the child in the interview. So you would say something like, if I ask you a question and you don't understand what I mean or what I'm saying, you can say, I don't know what you mean, or I don't understand. And then you ask them, will you do that? They usually say yes. And then you say an example, because children cognitively work best with examples. And then so I would ask, what if I asked you, where are your phalanges? You know, what five-year-old would know that? And so the five-year-old might say, what's that?
Yeah, I don't understand.
Okay. And I would say, exactly, because phalanges is a very difficult word. It actually means fingers. So if I asked you, where are your fingers? Can you show me?
Yeah.
Right? And then they'll show you. And you say, exactly. I will use a word that you understand, and I will try to ask it in a way you understand. Is that okay? You know? And then the next thing you move to is the third instruction, which is the you're wrong instruction. Mm-hmm. The reason we have this instruction is, you know, you and I, we're on the same level because we're adults. But when there's a child and an adult in the room, children are taught from the very beginning, you have to respect your adults. Your adults know better than you. Now, if they know you're an interviewer or a police officer or a parent or somebody, that authority gets heightened even more.
Yeah, they want to please you.
Yes, they don't want to be wrong. So they want to match what they think you think or what they think that you want to hear. Mm-hmm. But you don't want that. You want them to tell you. So you say, sometimes I make mistakes or I say the wrong thing. When I do that, you can tell me that I'm wrong. So if I say, you are a 65-year-old man, what would you say to that? And a lot of times they laugh. Especially
you're
the
wrong.
Little, right? You're wrong. Or they'll just say no, and then they'll giggle. And you can say, exactly, because how old are you? Mm-hmm. And are you a boy or a girl? And, you know, they'll explain to you. And then I'll say, you know, that's exactly right. I want you to correct me. Sometimes in that conversation, I like to add, just because I'm an adult doesn't mean I know everything. Because only you know, and that leads to the next question, which is the ignorant interviewer. Mm-hmm. You want the child to believe, not only am I on the same level with you in this interview, I know less than you about what happened to you, because only you know what happened to you. So that's exactly what you say. I don't know what happened to you, and I won't be able to tell you the answers to my questions. And you do that because you don't want anything you do to signal to that child that you want them to say yes or no or describe something. It has to come entirely from them. And I can sort of speed through the next parts. Number 5 is just a promise to tell the truth. And there's a specific line of questioning to, you know, get them to promise they won't lie to you. Mm-hmm. And then you need to test also, how young is the child? Do they understand the difference between a truth and a lie? So today I'm sitting here in a striped shirt with you. And if I was sitting with a child, I might say, okay, if I told you I was wearing a bright purple feathery shirt, is that a truth or a lie? And they'll usually say, it's a lie. That's wrong. Okay. If I told you I was wearing a striped top, would that be a truth or a lie? The truth. So you're establishing competency, the ability to understand and communicate. Mm-hmm. And then after that, step 6 is really dedicated to practice narratives to test if that child can tell a coherent story, even if very simple, you know, something like, when was your last birthday? Tell me all about that. What did you do from the beginning to the middle to the end? And you see how open that is? Tell me about that. I'm not implying anything and I'm not feeding any answers because I want the child to be the star and tell me everything. And it also just tests their ability to talk about those things.
And tell the whole story.
Yes, exactly. And then you can always fill in by asking follow-up questions, mm-hmm. but letting them get that first narrative out is important. Sometimes the child is very shy or reticent. So they might not be able to do the narrative part really well, but that doesn't prevent the interview from going. It just tells the interview, okay, the interviewer, okay, I have to be really patient with this child, very gentle. And you have to match the tone and the dynamics with what that child needs. So seven is getting into the allegations. And sometimes the child might say from the beginning, you know I'm here to talk about my dad or my uncle or somebody. But sometimes they don't want to talk about it. So you need to transition into this terrible topic. And sometimes we'll use strategies like, tell me why you think you're here to talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what the child thinks. And they already know you're interviewing them about something, right? And they know this terrible thing happened and they know they had disclosed to somebody. So they usually put two and two together. But sometimes they're really hesitant and maybe they're really young and they're not chronologically thinking about that. Mm-hmm. So then you might say something like, I heard that you, and then insert, I heard that you spoke with a police officer at school. Can you tell me all about that? Or, you know, I heard you told your mom something this morning. Can you tell me about that? Or whatever the disclosure was. And then from there, you just do follow-up. So step eight is following up on that. Tell me all about that. What happened next? And we like to ask the WH questions. Who, what, where, when, and then how stands out on its own. But how can be confusing for very little children. They're very concrete thinkers. So, you know, what happened next? What did he do? Where was his hand? Those sorts of things. Who was it? And then number nine, step nine would be just following up again with tell me more about that, what happened, you know, what were you feeling at the time? And then sometimes you want to break it up. What were you feeling up here in your mind and what were you feeling in your heart? Sometimes they distinguish thinking from emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And then sometimes you say, what were you feeling in your body? So sometimes it'll be pain or some people will say, I felt cold or hot or both. So it's interesting the different responses you get from children depending on their age. And then finally, if there were more than one incident, then you want to sort of distinguish those incidents if you can. Sometimes children will say it happened every day all the time. Can you tell me about the last time that you can remember? And then they'll talk about that. And you can distinguish that from maybe the time there was a blue carpet or maybe the time they were in a car. And then that way you're establishing that it happened more than once. And in California, we don't require every separate incident to be charged. We can charge representative counts and we can file based on a long time period. It doesn't have to be a specific day because we don't want to put the onus on the child to remember it happened on October 1st, 2019. Yeah. So that's the 10-step process. We generally like to follow that. And it can even be a helpful tool post-disclosure, post-interview in the courtroom.
I can imagine that child, when starts speaking about such thing, it can be really, really difficult, especially when a child is aware of the situation, when it's a little bit older. So I'm interested in how do you deal with severe emotional distress when the child is disclosing to you, especially?
Yes. You know, I work on the end of being in the law enforcement process. Mm-hmm. So typically for me, it happens in a stage where my primary focus is to hold this person accountable. The reason is in these child abuse or child sexual abuse cases, the recidivism rate is higher. And so one of the concerns is I can't change what happened to this child, but I need to, as a public servant, as a prosecutor, I need to try to safeguard other children this person could come into contact with. So it's a difficult position because on the one hand, I need to elicit this information from this child. And on the other hand, I know it can be painful and hard to talk about. So what I do is once we're in the court process and that first forensic interview happens, during that interview, we try to give them all the support they need, whether it's a therapy dog to sit with them, a squishy ball to, you know, take their stress out on. Some people like to color. I had a 16-year-old girl who just wanted to scribble nothing. And she said if she kept her hands busy, her ears could hear me better. And it's a way to help her focus, right? So whatever they need, some people, they want to lay on the floor. I will sit down on the floor with them. Or some people want to not look at me. Mm-hmm. And that's okay too. You know, I told them, you can't offend me or hurt my feelings. I'm only here to help you. So making them understand everything I'm doing is to hold this person accountable and to hear their story and give them a voice. In court, it can be a little different because that means we've done the interview. We think there's a case and we're pursuing justice for this case. And, you know, I have had a child, as she was walking up to the stand to testify, her legs froze and she could not move. And I told her, you know, all the nice ways to try to, like, it'll be over sooner if you get up there. Do you want me to take a break and ask the judge if you could come back in 20 minutes? You know, nothing was working. And finally, she was holding her advocate's hand and the leash for our court support dog. And then I just told her, you need to get your butt in that stand now. Because once you get up there, I promise you I will get you off that stand as quickly as I can. And we can get over this hump, but it's like ripping off a Band-Aid. We got to do it now. And she just needed a little bit of tough love, but she trusted me because we've met, you know, dozens of times before. And I think through that trust, I was able to talk to her in mm-hmm. that way. And she got on the stand and she really struggled. But at the end, you know, she just felt this huge weight off her shoulders. We've had children in court faint, right? We've had children vomit. It is an incredibly painful process for them. So I think being understanding and building that trust is important. And I'm sort of digressing, but one of the things to get us to that point in being sensitive to protect the child's emotional and mental well-being is that relationship the prosecutor can have. Mm-hmm. I don't just want to be the person they see for the first interview and then in court. Or, you know, if I didn't do the interview and someone else did the interview, I don't want the first time to be in court because then I'm going to ask them these horrible questions. Once I get a case, I like to meet with the child. I like to find out their needs. And then my personal practice is I keep a file on things they tell me that are not related to the case. So their favorite color is purple, or they've always wanted to go to Hawaii, or they really want to get their ears pierced, but their mom won't let them. And so I'll take these notes so the next time I see them in a month or two, I can say, did you ever get your ears pierced? Or I'll say, hey, I saw this person with this purple haircut, purple hair dye, and I thought of you because I know purple's your favorite color. Or they might tell me about a movie they watched, and I'll watch that movie if I have time so I can talk about it with them next time. But then they know I'm putting the time into remembering them, and I'm doing things like watching that movie because I care about them. And that really builds that trust. And then when you tell them you need to get your butt in that chair, they will get their butt in that chair. And I'm laughing, but it also speaks to just how resilient these children can also be and how amazingly courageous they can be.
I'm speechless because, well, having someone be so thoughtful and so caring after they know that you survived something traumatic, it can be really helpful. But the thing that you care so much, it is a wonderful thing. And those children are really unlucky that they have survived such horrible crimes. But they are kind of lucky to get to work with you because you care so much and your approach is wonderful.
Thank you. I'm always looking to improve. There's always things we can do to make ourselves better. So one of the things I like to do is to meet with people like you and people in the community because you're always learning something new. And, you know, sometimes people say because I'm the lawyer, they like to defer to me or let me, you know, take the lead. Mm-hmm. But sometimes the social worker or the victim advocate or another community member knows best how to work with this child. Or they see me do something that might trigger something that child has an issue with, and I don't know. So I always invite them to correct me or tell me when the child's not there, how best can I serve this child? And then I'll take notes to try to remember to do that. And even things like, a recent movement that we're trying to make everybody conscious of in our office, and I say recent, the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, we want to be really sensitive about how people self-identify. So my pronouns are she, her, hers, but some people want to be they, them, theirs, or some people outwardly might appear female and want to be referred to as he and his, and so he, him, and his. And I think asking a child that can be helpful, because even though it might seem black and white to the child, identity might not be. And so being sensitive to that is something that we're, you know, also practicing. And I have had several children where that was an issue, and being sensitive to that is really important.
Yeah, and those are the little things where you show that you care.
Exactly.
And that is really important in those cases.
Yes, and anyone dealing with a child disclosing this kind of abuse.
You mentioned the therapy dog, and that is something really interesting to me. How helpful is having animal in the whole process of talking to a child that has survived child sexual abuse?
I think it can sometimes make the difference between the child being able to disclose and the child not being able to disclose.
Really?
Yes. And I have had a situation where a child just did not want to talk to me. And I don't take it personally. It doesn't have to be me. They just don't want to talk about these horrible things. And you'll see in almost all the children I work with, they say, I don't want to remember. I don't want to think about it. I try to forget.
Yeah, and how can
how could you not? Exactly. And so talking to me is like reopening a wound. But if you bring the dog, there's studies that show, you know, it elevates their endorphins and other positive chemicals in the body. It brings dopamine into the brain. And there's something happy and joyful about this cute, fuzzy dog. And he has a very calming presence. Our dog, Percy, he knows over 90 commands. I think it's actually over 100 commands now. And they're all things to help the child relax. When they're in court, he sleeps at their feet. He's a calming presence. You know, he brings that energy of relaxation and calm. But he's also very stable and reliable. He's not too excitable. He's just a solid, friendly presence and a warm presence. That, for some children, it makes all the difference. Having him there, they don't feel alone, but he is a dog, so he's also not judging them. Having that interaction with him is great, and for court or during the interview, if they want to take a break, they can walk around with Percy, go outside, give him a treat, and it sort of alleviates the stress of having talked about these issues. So I'm a strong believer in court support animals. I'm a dog lover myself, an animal lover, and I know how happy I am when I see a dog. So I can only imagine if I was having a terrible day or I had to talk about something traumatic, having that support from a non-human support system is just one more layer that can really make a difference.
And how do you decide that is a right time to bring the dog into the situation? Do you immediately do it, or do you do it if you just have to do it in
a way? So it really depends on the survivor. And what I mean by that is we also want to be culturally sensitive. In some people's families, dogs are not positive animals. Some religions, you know, dogs are not maybe considered clean or things like that. Okay. And it depends on the sect and, you know, what their specific beliefs are. Some people are scared of dogs. I had one little girl say, can I bring my emotional support hamster because it's small and cute? And she's like, I'm really afraid of big dogs. So although she loves animals, Percy was not right for her. So you have to get to know your survivor, to know your child. And then you sort of ask them the question, we have this dog. Is that something you're interested in? And if it is, let's do a meeting with just the dog and we'll get to know the dog. Once in a very rare circumstances, it's never happened to me. Maybe the dog and the child don't click, or maybe the child's not that interested in the dog and it's not really helpful. Then we wouldn't use that animal in the future proceedings. But if it really helps them and they feel really good about seeing him, I try to schedule him for every single interaction I have with the child. But we only have one court support animal, Percy, for our entire county. And that's because it's very expensive to do the training, mm-hmm. And to get county approval. And we had another dog, Darcy, come, but then she had health issues. So we're working on getting more court support animals in the interim. But if he's booked for two different things, sometimes one child will not have him and one child will. And it just, you try to get in your requests as soon as possible to make sure that the child you're working with has that. But, you know, you're still conscious of the needs of the other child. So if that child is much more vulnerable, you have to sort of work out with the other prosecutor where Percy will go.
This whole subject with court support animals is really special to me because I'm an animal lover too. So I really think that all of the animals have such a calming presence. And
yes.
I have cats, and cats really, really help me when I'm stressed. Mm-hmm. So I can only imagine how does that help to the children. And I thought about it when you talked about it in the conference. What about children getting attached to the dog because they are disclosing something that is traumatic and they have the dog's presence that is calming and everything? How do you say to a child when the child is really young, well, we cannot bring that dog home because that is not our dog?
We do have that conversation early because we say he works for the court mm-hmm. system. So it's his job, like a counselor or, you know, your advocate who's sitting here. You can't take your advocate home with you. You know, you can't take your court staff home with you. You can't take me home with you, but we're here for you anytime you have to talk about the case, and we'll do our best. And I always tell them from the beginning, I can promise you nothing. I cannot promise you 100% Percy will be there. I can't promise you 100% we will convict this person of the crimes. And I can't tell you 100% what the sentence will be. I can only promise that I will always be honest with you and that I will work very, very hard on your case and that I will always find a way to make time for you if you need me or if you have questions. So I make that commitment because I'm the owner of my time and I can make that work, even if it's a night call or early morning call or a lunchtime call. I will make that happen. But because there are things I can't control, I do not ever want to let this child down for things I promise them. So they kind of already know with Percy, mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, in control of that. And because he's working and jobs take us multiple ways, they do understand that concept.
Your dedication to work is something that really amazes me. And now with this a little bit more outgoing conversation, I learned a lot more from you than at the conference. And I would love to hear from you. Do you have any advice for people who are interested in working in your field, whether are those young lawyers or maybe social workers or any person who could find themselves wondering about their career and they choosing this path? Do you have any advices you wish you heard when you started doing this as your job?
That's a really great question because it's hard to answer. I think there's a couple things I wish I knew. So I'll think on that as I'm answering what I would also consider going into my field, starting specifically with being a prosecutor. And maybe this also ties into being in law enforcement generally. Mm-hmm. But when I was in law school, I considered going into criminal defense, so to work on the side of the whoever the offender of whatever the crime is. And part of that interest was to make sure they had their rights observed and protected. And I was very interested in the idea of maintaining justice, especially for people wrongly accused and things like that. But I talked to many professors in my law school, and they said, if you become a prosecutor, you can take that love and desire to uphold justice into your job. So if you think you got the wrong guy, you have the power to dismiss the case because it's not the right thing to do. But if you think this person is an extreme danger to society or children or whoever, then you can accordingly charge them with the crimes they should be facing and hold that person accountable, or do all you can to hold that person accountable. And throughout the process of the court system and working in the court system, it's our office's belief and our practice that upholding the law also means upholding the rights of the defendants while also fighting for the victims and respecting the court process. So at the end of the day, if you want to be a prosecutor, I think you should be somebody who always wants to do the right thing. And it's not about winning. You know, mm-hmm. I don't get paid more if I get a good verdict or a bad verdict or a bad outcome of a case. I feel like when I go to work, I can hold my head up high because I believe in the work that I'm doing. And I truly feel that I'm serving my community. And the defendants, the offenders, are part of that community. The victims are part of that community, our survivors, and just our community and society at large. So if that's something that speaks to whoever's out there listening to this, that is, I think, a defining feature for good prosecutors and people in law enforcement. So if that rings true for you, this could be a great profession for you. Some things I wish I knew, the amount of sleepless nights. I was in a trial very recently, and I woke up in the middle of the night, maybe around 2 a.m, and I was giving a closing argument in my dream. And I woke up and I wrote down the argument on a notepad next to my bed, and I went back to sleep. Because even in my dreams, I'm thinking about my cases. So it can be heavy, even though I love the work. So for people who are in this field of work or want to go in this field of work, you have to remember to take time to be well yourself as also. Because if you're not at your best, how can you serve these children? How can you fight for them when you're not 100%? So I think you should have hobbies and be mindful about your mental health, emotional health. That's why I have a dog. I like to go hiking. I love to travel. I'm very, very happy that my work and travel, love for travel, coincided and I was able mm-hmm. to come to Serbia. Such a beautiful country, by the way. I've just loved every single minute here, and the people,
I'm
just
really glad.
So warm and lovely. I really am enjoying my time, and I very much hope to come back one day. But, you know, finding that balance in life is important, again, because it will help you do the work better. So that's something I think I wish I had known and I had started earlier in my career, but I'm being more conscious about it now.
Yeah, that is the something a lot of people ask me when I tell them what am I doing, because I'm not working directly with children, but I heard of the stories and I sometimes meet the children and greet them. And after that, hearing their story, it makes me really sad, but I'm working really hard not to bring all of those stories home with me, because I have to make those things separate. But it is not always easy because, well, as you said, you've been thinking about the whole case in your head, like while sleeping. Yeah. So that happens to all of the people working with, such difficult cases.
Yes, and we call that vicarious trauma. So even though you said you don't work directly with these kids, hearing their stories and learning about them as people, because you're kind and you have a big heart and you care, you're going to bring that home in some way. And that's experiencing vicarious trauma through their negative experience. So, you know, hold your cats close and make sure you take care of yourself as well.
I am trying. And one thing that popped into my mind right now is how do you deal with injustice? Sometimes you cannot bring justice. Sometimes it is really, it just happens that way. You don't have any, how do you say it?
Closure.
You don't have a closure. You don't have all of the details you have to have a case. Mm-hmm. So that's injustice, because in my job, I learned that you always have to believe the victim first until you prove that they are maybe lying or that they are.
Or you can't prove it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you cannot prove. So how do you deal with that injustice?
I think the best way I can answer that is to tell you about a case I had. So I had a case where a young girl disclosed that her biological father had been abusing her sexually for years and years and years. And this case belonged to an attorney before it came to me, but then he switched teams, so he had to go somewhere else. When I got the case, she had already testified at the first hearing, not the trial, so the preliminary hearing, what we call a probable cause hearing. And she's really struggled through it. And you could just see in the transcript, we get a written transcript of the proceedings, she was crying every step of the way. And the prosecutor who was questioning her had to try to keep it as simple as possible because he just didn't want to hurt her. And he's trying to balance proving it and not harming her. COVID hit. We had so many delays with that case. And then finally, the defense also switched attorneys a few times. And then finally, it came to this one attorney. And she told me, you know, now that I've had a chance to review it, we're going to set the case for trial. There were lots of things in the first hearing we couldn't ask her because she just wasn't in a place to be asked. So I just thought, we'll address it at the trial and she'll be able to clarify these things. Unfortunately, I advised her and her mother that the case was set for trial. And she obviously knows what that means. And within 48 hours, she took her own life. And I have to tell you, when I got that news, I think that was one of the hardest days of my life.
I can only imagine.
And, you know, even now when I think about it, I just remember my heart dropping and my whole body went hot and cold. And I was on the phone with the advocate who was crying because she had just gotten the call from her mom, from the survivor's mom, the victim's mom in this case. And it was just so hard. And that disappointment is greater than not securing a conviction or not, you know, filing charges. Because even if I convicted him, we could do nothing for her. And her mom had tried getting her in counseling and therapy and services, knowing that she was dealing with this heavy burden of trauma. And she wasn't ready. She wasn't ready to take advantage of those services either. And we just, you know, the system didn't work. And I know your question is, how do you deal with that? And I think it's still something I struggle with now because you can't let go of that.
Yeah.
How do you deal with something like that? I think my only advice for any people out there who face a similar situation to me, and in talking to her mom, a similar situation as her mom, you can't blame yourself. What happened to her is the perpetrator. The perpetrator did this to her. And then what happened to her, of course, we all wish, you know, had we forced her into services? I don't know. I don't know that the outcome would be different. But I had to remind myself, just because I told her the trial was set doesn't mean I caused her death, right? And it is hard because it feels like that. It feels like it's my fault. And her mom said the same thing. Oh, if I had just forced her into therapy or I forced her to go. But if you forced her, it wouldn't work the same way for her. It wouldn't be as effective. And, you know, her mom said, what if I didn't work that second job? And what if I was watching her every minute? Well, then how do you put food on the table and support your other two daughters? And so I think not blaming yourself, but only trying to look forward and move forward and provide support for the family and future survivors like her, that's the best thing that we can do. But it is something that I'm still trying to figure out myself.
Yeah, I can imagine that it is really hard. But in that situation, I think every person who worked closely with a child blames themselves. Because yes. What if I did something different? Yes. Maybe the outcome would be different. So,
but you'll drive yourself crazy with the what ifs. There's 1,000 what ifs and we just don't know. So my first step in that case was immediately to meet with the family, meet with her sisters, make sure everybody's getting help and support services, and then helping that family. And then I tried to figure out, was there a way to do the case without her? And based on the defense evidence that they provided, we couldn't prove it anymore. So we had to dismiss the case. So 2 strikes of disappointment, one much greater was the loss of the child, but then not being able to try to hold him accountable, it just felt, you know, very difficult and very heavy. But that is also just how the system works. And if we couldn't prove the case, the legal justice system says we can't hold this man anymore.
Mm-hmm. But all of those things, if we try to simplify it, build your experience. And maybe if you tell yourself that, well, this thing didn't work out, but next time I will know better, I will do better, I will change something. And I think that it is important that every time something disappointing happens, you will learn and then you implement that on the other case. And I think that that is something you have been given the chance to improve. And unfortunately, there will be another child that survives something similar. Mm-hmm. And then you will know how to act.
Yeah.
But
although it is very individual, because every child is different too. But I do mm-hmm. agree with you. Whether it's something I can actually do, like a practical thing I could change, or even if there's nothing I could have changed looking back, having that experience does, while it hurts, I think it makes me stronger too, because it's something that it helps me understand the pain that the survivor is going through better and seeing it play out. I've taken even more sensitivity to the cases when I'm working with survivors. So I think your point is really well made.
Thank you. For the end of this really, really productive and pleasant conversation, I wanted to ask you, what changes would you like to implement, or would you love to be implemented in the future in your field that maybe aren't there now, but should be? Mm-hmm. Do you have something that you would love to maybe implement in your job, or that other people should implement and make it a good practice?
So if you could give me 5 more hours, I can talk to you through all those things. There are many things we can always do to do better. But the very first thing that comes to my mind, specific to the child sexual assault, sexual abuse type cases, is we need a lot more funding dedicated to the victim advocates and the support systems. You know, prosecutors are overworked, but, you know, we still function in a role of knowing the law, going to court, and, you know, doing these cases. But there's so many things behind the doors when we're in court that the advocates do, and they don't get enough support. You know, they make a fraction salary-wise of what prosecutors make, and their work is extremely important. And I think there were times that I wouldn't have been able to connect as well with a child if an advocate didn't tell me mm-hmm. things about that child that they knew, that the additional, you know, 40 meetings they had or whatever it is, they learned these things about the child so that they could help fill in my gaps and really help me be effective in working with that child. And they put in those hours and they don't get the support they need, and their caseloads are monstrously large. And those organizations don't get enough funding. They have a lot of turnover because people burn out. So if communities, counties, districts can put more funding into that victim support branch and have more programs, more therapeutic access, more counseling access, more mental health, more family interventions, because mm-hmm. a lot of the sexual assault's interfamilial, that would be amazing. You know, in terms of the law, I said at the conference, just the way our constitution is written, I don't think we can implement what Serbia has in place. But this idea that you could designate a survivor as a special victim or a special status victim,
mm-hmm.
and it's or even witness, because a child could witness violence, and because they're yes. witness, be a special status person. The fact that they get that status and then are never in the same room as the perpetrator, can testify through a closed circuit television, have the questions posed by the judge after the judge vets them from the attorneys. Those are all wonderful ideas. And I don't know if we could somehow modify it to fit the laws we have in mm-hmm. the United States and California specifically. But I really like that idea. And maybe forming a finding, a way for a judge to say, if these three elements are met with this child's circumstances, then we trigger this special victim status while balancing the defendant in America, the Sixth Amendment right to confrontation, while balancing those rights. That would be a very interesting procedure. We have something like that with the CCTV, but it's very hard to get and very rarely implemented. So that would be something that I would love to look into. And this is exactly why I'm so glad I came, because both sides can learn from different countries and jurisdictions' practices. So,
yeah, it makes me really happy to hear that our country is doing something great, because, hearing about the stories of children that survived trauma or any abuse, especially sexual abuse, it feels sometimes that our justice system is not good enough. But hearing from you that even though it sometimes feels bad because you care about those children, hearing that something is done right, it brings a little bit of peace, just a little bit.
I think every single justice system will have flaws, because nothing human-made can be absolutely perfect, and rules governing humans will never be perfect, because we can't categorize human behavior. But I think when legislators and lawmakers, judges, prosecutors, people in the criminal justice system, defense attorneys, community members, nonprofits, if everybody wants to do justice, I think that will get us closer to the best system. And I think always being willing to change and learning and fitting the needs of society is the best way to go.
Thank you so much for this conversation. I have to say it. I just have to say that you have such a calming presence, really, because I'm an anxious person, because every time I have to speak with another stranger that is a specialized in some field I don't know much about, I feel really anxious. Will I say the right thing? And now doing this in another language is another barrier in my head.
Very impressed by your English, by the way.
Thank you. I was really worried, and I said to myself, oh my God, I will make so many mistakes, and now I will think about those mistakes. But you have such a calming presence that I forgot that I'm not speaking in my native language. So thank you so much for it.
Oh, of course. And thank you so much for having me. You have such great, insightful questions. And even though my job is to speak in public, I too get nervous all the time when I present. So this looks calm, but I'm not always calm. So thank you for saying that.
Thank you. And I would love to have you another time. So if you ever visit Serbia again, you are well welcome to speak another subject here on my podcast.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much again for having me.
Hvala što ste pratili još jednu epizodu Bezbedne priče. Nadam se da ste naučili nešto novo. Do sljedeće epizode zapratite naš Instagram, a pogotovo Instagram Bezbedne priče, gdje možete pronaći sve isečke iz prethodnih podcasta koje sam do sada snimila. Vidimo se!